You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It is spring election day here in Wisconsin. Polls are now open until 8 o'clock this evening, and we have election news and information all in one spot at wisconsinvote.org. Later this hour, we'll look at turnout trends from past spring elections. But first, let's get an update on what's next in the aftermath of the Mueller probe. A House committee is set to authorize a subpoena this week to obtain the full, unredacted report from Special Counsel Robert Mueller. What questions do you have about the release of the Mueller report? How much of the report should be made public? Let us know at 800-642-1234. Tweet us WPR Mornings. Kyle Chaney is staying on top of these developments. He's a Congress reporter for Politico. Kyle, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Great to be here, Kate. Thanks for having me.
So walk us through this. The Democratic chairman of the House Judiciary Committee says he's moving ahead with plans to press for this full 400-page report from Special Counsel Robert Mueller, and will try to do this with subpoenas. What's behind this move?
Sure. Well, so they actually set today as a deadline to receive the full report without any redactions at all. And they said if they don't get it by today, then they'll start that subpoena process tomorrow. Doesn't mean they will subpoena, but they know the Justice Department is not going to give them what they want by this deadline. Attorney General William Barr has suggested he'll give them a redacted version of this report by the middle of April, and then presumably there will be a big fight over how much of that report he's redacted. So the subpoenas are really to give the House leverage, the Democrats leverage, to begin that fight once they don't get what they're looking for from the Justice Department.
So once the subpoena process unfolds, who would be subpoenaed and who would be the ones doing this subpoenaing, if you will?
So it will be the House Judiciary Committee. The Chairman Gerald Nadler has the authority to issue subpoena. Now, the vote that the House will take tomorrow, that the committee will take tomorrow, is not to actually issue the subpoena. It's just to give Nadler the authority to subpoena at any time. So he can still have that in his back pocket and try to work with the Justice Department. But he's got it there, and they know he'll use it if they don't play ball with what the Democrats want.
So do we know if the Democrats on this committee unanimously support this move?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think this was the big shift with the Democrats taking the House, was they got the subpoena power that Republicans used to their advantage in the previous Congress. That this is what they wanted. They wanted to conduct oversight. They wanted to be able to use their power as the House majority to compel this kind of information coming out publicly, or at least over to Congress. So the Democrats will certainly support this move. Republicans will oppose it. They think the Democrats are being too hostile and aggressive with the Justice Department at this stage. But it will pass because Democrats control the committee.
So I want to make sure here I understood you right. You know, the Democrats had demanded this deadline today from Attorney General William Barr to get this full report. Is it fair to say that their wish will not come true today, that they won't get the full report?
No, there's no chance they're going to get that full report by today. The Attorney General wants to withdraw or redact four major categories of information that Democrats say we have every right to see. And so at the very least, they would get some sort of scrubbed version of the report that's not acceptable to them. And so we'll be in for a fight one way or the other.
So Barr has offered this scrubbed version of this report. Is that basically all he is willing to offer at this point?
It seems to be the case. I think they're girding for a fight over this, too. The Democrats make the point that Republicans last Congress received all kinds of sensitive information, classified information, things involved in the Mueller investigation while it was still ongoing. When they demanded it. So Democrats are saying, we want the same treatment. We want to be able to see all these sensitive and investigative files that Republicans got access to last Congress. So the Justice Department has been through this fight before with Republicans and turned over a lot of stuff. So it's sort of a sequel, I guess, to that fight.
So we're talking with Kyle Chaney. Here's Congress reporter for Political. We're looking at the Mueller report and the work by Democrats to get the full report release unredacted and what that process would look like. Kyle, what are Republicans in Congress saying about all of this right now?
So they're willing to defer to the Justice Department at this point. They say, look, Attorney General Barr is making accommodations. He's redacting appropriately sensitive information like classified material, things that might be embarrassing to individuals who weren't charged with any crimes. So let him do his work and let's see what he turns over. They all say they want the report too, as much of it as public as possible, as much as Congress can access as possible, but they're not willing to go to battle with the DOJ just yet.
Democrats are also looking to authorize subpoenas for documents from 5 former Trump White House officials. Can you talk about what's going on there?
Sure. So these are people that are connected to the Mueller investigation, people like former White House counsel Don McGahn, people who are like former Trump advisor Steve Bannon and communications director Hope Hicks. So these are all people who are in the Trump inner circle and have a relationship to all of these matters. So it's just another way for the House to get leverage and sort of force information into the public if they don't expect to get cooperation from these individuals.
So in the process of all this getting information to the public and this forced information feed, we've been learning about alleged abuses of FISA, the Foreign Intelligence mm-hmm. Surveillance Act. What do we know there?
So that's at the heart of a lot of why Republicans have had major questions about the Russia investigation to begin with. They believe that politically motivated officials at the Justice Department used political charge information collected by the Clinton campaign essentially to justify getting a surveillance warrant on a Trump campaign advisor. There's a lot of disagreement about that. Democrats think that's way overblown and that charge itself is politically motivated. But it has led to questions about how the FBI used its very, very sensitive intelligence or surveillance powers against an American.
Do you have any sense as to how the public is feeling about this 400-page report and access to it? Do we have any polling data out there?
Yeah, there's been a number of polls, actually, and I can't recall the pollsters themselves at this point, but there have been several that suggest that people want to see this. They really want to know. On all sides of the aisle, it's bipartisan. You know, it's, at the end of the day, this is the report's been talked about for a couple of years. It's been, become a political football, and so people just want to know, what did Bob Mueller find? What is the evidence? And I think people won't be satisfied until that happens, that, the president's claims of total vindication or the Democrats' claims that maybe there still is evidence of collusion in there are answered.
Since the attorney general released his 4-page summary of the Mueller probe, there's been a lot of back and forth between Democrats and Republicans over this full release that we've been talking about. So what should we be watching for in the coming days and weeks that might be significant here? And what should we filter out?
Well, I would look for, do the Democrats actually issue that subpoena? That will tell you a lot about whether they feel like they're getting any cooperation with the Justice Department. It's all posturing right now until they take the actual step of issuing a subpoena. And then we have to see, does the Justice Department give any ground at all in terms of acknowledging that Congress has seen these sensitive categories of information before? And that's, the Democrats point out, look, in Watergate, during the Clinton investigation, the Starr report, like the Congress got access to all of this material, and therefore, why should we be treated any different now? So does the Justice Department give any ground at all in that area?
Kyle, thank you for joining us.
Great to be here, Kate. Thank you.
Kyle Chaney is a Congress reporter for Politico, and we've been talking about how congressional Democrats are demanding the full unredacted report on the Russia probe. Coming up, it is Election Day, and we'll talk next with a political scientist to understand voter turnout during spring elections historically. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're with us on The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. We're looking at spring election trends and voter turnout. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Polling sites throughout the state are open. They'll remain open until 8 o'clock tonight for the spring nonpartisan election. There is a statewide race for a seat on the Wisconsin Supreme Court. There are also local races. City, villages, towns will choose elected leaders. And near Madison, the Sun Prairie School District is asking voters to consider the largest referendum in the state to build a second high school. You can find voter information at wisconsinvote.org. Do you vote in spring elections? What is it about spring elections that makes you go to the polls or keeps you away? We're at 800-642-1234. We're going to take a look at some historical trend lines now on spring voter turnout with Barry Burden. He's a political science professor at UW-Madison. He directs the Elections Research Center. Barry, thanks for coming by.
Glad to be here.
So what does voter turnout look like in spring elections historically compared to other elections, say midterm elections, for instance?
Well, it's certainly lower and more variable. Over the last decade or so, these spring elections have varied anywhere from 15 or 16% turnout on the low end to over 40% on the high end if a presidential primary happens to be happening the same day.
Oh, so that coinciding of a presidential primary is perhaps luring more people to the polls?
Absolutely, especially when those are competitive, as in 2016 when the Republicans were still fighting out their presidential nomination and Wisconsin felt as though it had a stake in what was happening in that process. That tended to pull in voters who might not otherwise be attracted by a mayor's race or a Supreme Court race or something else happening.
What offices are spring elections for? What do we see on these ballots?
They're largely set aside for nonpartisan races, so they've been segregated from what happens in the traditional April or the August primary and then the November general election. So that would be Supreme Court races in Wisconsin, all of which are nonpartisan, local towns, villages, and cities that have city councils and village boards, mayoral elections, school referendums, school board members. So it's a variety of things from the state level to the local level that actually really impact people's lives. These are elections that are meaningful.
Yeah, what are the potential impacts spring elections can have on voters' lives?
Well, in Sun Prairie, as you mentioned, tax rates are going to be affected very immediately by the vote. So when you have a school referendum on the ballot, you know that it'll affect building and infrastructure and taxes. And so there's a very immediate impact there. I think for a lot of voters around the state who are voting on town councils and village boards and mayors, they're going to feel it when it comes to basic services like trash collection and public safety. You know, these are things that we experience on a day-to-day basis, and so these offices really matter.
And you've said that Supreme Court justices probably have more effect on people's daily lives than do members of Congress?
Yeah, I think that's right. Well, there are only 7 members of the Supreme Court, so each seat really matters, whereas in the U.S. Congress, there are 435 members of the House, and so one member doesn't have a lot of influence. But the Supreme Court is ruling on things all of the time that affect, again, Wisconsinites' daily lives, whether it's regulation or the environment or taxes or labor law or controversial issues like voter ID and redistricting and other kinds of things. So it runs the gamut of issues that I think Wisconsinites really care about.
We've seen more people, it seems, become politically active on the left in recent years. Do you think that could have an impact on voter turnout in spring elections?
This election will be a good gauge of that. Democrats had a good run last year, winning a Supreme Court seat that was viewed as favorable to them a year ago this time, and then having a good set of results in the November election, winning 5 statewide races, which was a real success. And so now I think this is a test to see whether we've turned a corner and things have gone back to a more competitive situation, or whether Democrats are still really in the driver's seat.
We're talking with Barry Burden. He's a professor of political science at UW-Madison, directs the Elections Research Center. We're looking at some trend lines in spring elections and what spring elections, the impact they make for voters' lives. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you vote in spring elections historically? What drives you to the polls? What keeps you away? Call in. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Barry, people are perhaps more motivated to vote in partisan elections, but can there be downsides to that?
Yeah. So as we mentioned, this was done intentionally to separate nonpartisan races where I think policymakers didn't want partisanship to be a big part of the conversation and wanted to emphasize competence and experience. So in choosing a mayor or Supreme Court justice, wanted to take partisanship out of the equation. That has a downside in that turnout tends to be lower in races where partisanship's not on the ballot as a cue and where the parties aren't really invested in the campaign. So I think there are upsides in trying to insulate these elections. It does feel over time as though they become more partisan. I think most voters have a sense in the two Supreme Court candidates who are on the ballot today that one is associated with Democrats and folks on the left, and one is associated with the Republican Party and folks on the right. But nonetheless, we maintain the veneer, at least, that these are nonpartisan. But it does have that side effect, unfortunately, of drawing fewer people into the process.
Is that pull, that trend toward partisan politics, you see growing over time, that these spring elections have become more and more political?
They have, at least for the Supreme Court. That's the one that's at the top of the ballot. And I think both sides really feel as though there's a lot at stake. The court has been weighing in on more important issues over time to the parties. And so they and their allies have begun dumping money into these races and actively recruiting candidates. And I think really endorsing one side or the other in a pretty open way. So it's true that there are no party labels on the ballot. But for the set of people who vote in these elections, they tend to be more informed and engaged kinds of voters because turnout's lower. And I think they have a pretty good sense of what direction the court will go based on who wins.
I wonder what the impact of media coverage is on these elections, because in a spring election where there are more community-based initiatives on the ballot, perhaps smaller races or mayors or things like that, where perhaps they don't get as much attention from news sources.
No, it's true. And we've seen local press wither away over the last decade or two, really, as the internet has taken over. And so the lack of coverage, the less intense coverage in these campaigns is just less stimulating for voters. These campaigns feel much shorter. I don't think it feels that way to the candidates, but to voters, it feels like it's just been a few weeks we've been talking about these races, whereas a congressional race or a presidential race may run on for a year or two. So it feels as though we've not quite got to the saturation point where people have all the information they would like, but it's election day and here we are.
Perhaps in some respects we feel closer to 2020, and we could just call it 2020, the presidential campaign, than we do in our own small community elections.
It would be ironic if the average person on the street knew more about the 20 Democrats who are running for president, where the Iowa caucuses are almost a year away, than they knew about who was running for mayor or city council.
When you look at these trend lines from spring elections, what are some research-oriented things that you try to draw out, that you try to glean from them?
Well, we're interested in who participates. When turnout is as low as 20% in some of these elections, you worry that skews the electorate in a particular direction, and it does. Research shows that the voters in these low turnout elections tend to be older, higher education, higher income, more partisan, and so they probably represent a different set of interests than the average voter. Also, when there's a specific office on the ballot, like a school board race, it tends to draw out parents, teachers, teachers' unions members, people who have a stake in what's happening in the schools. And it's helpful to have those people involved in the election, but they're not a representative swath of the electorate. So the lower turnout goes, I think the more political scientists become concerned that we're really drawing an unrepresentative group of people to participate and make decisions for all of us.
Have there been any efforts in Wisconsin to increase turnout for spring elections?
There is a little talk now and then about rescheduling these elections, maybe consolidating them with what happens in the fall. It would be complicated because then the ballot would need to have both partisan and nonpartisan races. But research from other states shows that would definitely increase turnout. So we have to decide whether we want to contaminate the nonpartisan races by putting them on the fall ballot. There is a sense, I think, in Wisconsin of election fatigue. We've just been through a year, in a November election that was pretty intense 3 months ago, 4 months ago. Here we are back at it. We had an election in February in the state and again in April. The frequency of elections is a driver in the negative direction for turnout. We vote in Wisconsin and in the United States generally much more than in other democracies around the country,
around the world. How big of an issue could fatigue be? How much of an issue could that be on the ballot, perhaps, and in getting people to turn out? Have you seen that across the country?
Yeah, we have. In places with more frequent elections and with longer ballots, where there are more issues on the ballot, voters tend to drop off and sort of pick and choose the races and times that matter to them. it's work to be a voter. There's information to be gathered, and at some point people want to return to their regular lives and not be focused on what's happening in the next election. Looking at the weather today, by the way, there is some research on rain and turnout, and it suggests that more precipitation reduces turnout, but more so when elections are not especially competitive. So in uncompetitive races, an additional inch of rain decreases turnout by about a percentage point or two.
Really?
So not a huge effect, but enough that you notice it.
Let's put that in the category of fun fact to know and tell.
Right. Yes. Dinner party chatter. Exactly.
Well, Barry, thank you so much for coming by.
Glad to be here. Thanks.
Barry Burden is a professor of political science at UW-Madison and director of the Elections Research Center. And on this spring election day, polls are open until 8 o'clock. Up next, it's news. Then does Americans' obsession with Marie Kondo go beyond our perennial love-hate relationship with decluttering? Our guest argues that we're drawn to her because we see her spiritual approach to tidying up as an exotic, otherworldly fix that is different from Western issues. We'll talk about it. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. We're talking about how we view the spiritual side of Marie Kondo and decluttering here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Americans seem to be in a purging frenzy thanks to the Netflix show Tidying Up with Marie Kondo. The impact of the Japanese home organizing consultant is said to be felt at charities and thrift shops that are being inundated with extra donations. Here she is introducing her KonMari method on YouTube.
I have an important question to ask you. Is your home tidy? Even if your answer is no, no problem.
So we're not tackling clutter in this conversation. Instead, we're exploring how Americans' response to the KonMari frenzy has ties to centuries-old racist attitudes toward Asian cultures and religions. Have you watched Marie Kondo's show on Netflix? Did you connect with the more spiritual parts of her tidying up method? Why or why not? We're at 800-642-1234. Melissa Borja is an assistant professor of American culture at the University of Michigan, and she specializes in refugee migration and Asian American religion. Melissa, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
So it's been 4 years now since Marie Kondo's book, The Life-Changing Magic of Tidying Up, and now she's got this really popular Netflix show. Why do you think Americans are so fascinated with her?
Well, I think there are a lot of reasons why she addresses needs that we Americans have right now. I mean, we could point to the fact that we are overwhelmed with clutter and overconsumption. But I think an important dimension of her appeal is the fact that she embodies the Oriental monk trope. And by Oriental monk, I'm using Jane Iramura's idea of an Asian sage who offers life-changing guidance to Western audiences who are eager for wisdom and personal transformation. So it is partly because she represents a magical, exotic, oriental, religious set of beliefs and practices.
And so this, as you say, is an example of this racist cliche that dates back at least a century. Have you been seeing this all along in her rise, or has this spiritual identity as part of Marie Kondo evolved for Western viewers?
Yeah, I think it's important to see that there has always been a hunger for people like Marie Kondo. Again, as you mentioned, it goes back a century. If we look at movies like Broken Blossom from 1919, a film by D.W. Griffith, we look at characters like Mr. Miyagi in The Karate Kid or Charlie Chan. There has always been this fascination with people who are Asian and wise and magical. And Marie Kondo, while she is in many ways a departure from those previous Oriental monks, she reinforces some of that fascination. I don't think it's an accident that Americans love her so much. And I also don't necessarily think it's an accident that she might recognize that dimension of her appeal and make use of that, both in her book and her television show.
So we know that she practices Shintoism, which is a traditional Japanese religion. Can you tell us more about that? Do you think, American audiences are aware of that?
Yeah, this is something that has come up in the past. It's useful to look at the television show today and also read the book that became very popular about 5 years ago. And in the book, more so than in the television show, she describes her role as a Shinto shrine maiden and how that was instrumental to her approach, her distinctive approach to tidying up called the KonMari method. And she describes how her relationship to objects, as well as the feeling of anticipation that one has in undertaking a tidying up project, is informed by her Shinto beliefs and practices. Now, it's interesting to note that is largely why I think she is appealing, or one reason why I think she's appealing to American audiences, but some people have been uncomfortable with it. There have been some more conservative Christians who have wondered, is it okay to do the KonMari method? Is it in conflict with my Christian beliefs? On the whole, though, I do think that people have found her Shinto approach to be one reason why she is new and fresh and exciting.
We're talking with Melissa Borja. She's an assistant professor of American culture at the University of Michigan. And we're looking more deeply at Marie Kondo, her decluttering mission, but also the spiritual side of that and how that is perceived in the West. You can join in this discussion at 800-642-1234. Have you noticed the spiritual side of Marie Kondo? And what do you make of it? Perhaps you see parallels to your own spiritual practices and the approaches that you take to your life and your home. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Tweet us, WPR Mornings. So Marie Kondo's book, which made her famous, it's called The Life-Changing Magic of Tidying Up, The Japanese Art of Decluttering and Organizing. What do you see as the significance of that title, those words?
Yeah, I see in that title the Oriental monk trope encapsulated perfectly. You have, on one hand, an emphasis on the magical dimensions of it, the spiritual, life-changing dimensions of this East-West spiritual East-West encounter. But you also have, in the second half of the title, the Japanese-ness of it, the otherness, the Asian-ness, that is also an important part of this longstanding trope. I see that transformation and that Asianness being very present in the book, but it's also very present in what she does in the television show. The stories that people share at the end of each episode about how Marie Kondo has been their mentor, how she has helped them tidy up not just their homes, but their relationships with their spouses, their children. It's really powerful to see that through a religious lens, and see that as almost a story, a narrative of spiritual transformation as much as home transformation.
So for people who may not be familiar with her approach, can you describe the way she helps people clean up their homes on perhaps her Netflix show and how it's more of a spiritual approach than typical decluttering?
So this is a really interesting aspect of this show. She goes to homes of a variety of different families. She has LGBT families. She has families of different racial and ethnic backgrounds, young families, old families. They're all really different. But one thing that is always very consistent is that at the beginning of every episode, there is a ritual in which she greets the home. Sometimes she describes it as thanking the home. But in that moment, the episode suspends. There is music. There are close-up of the hands of the family members as they bow their heads, almost as if they're saying the Lord's Prayer, and hold hands. And it is this really powerful moment that is consistent in every episode that really grounds each show in this spiritual experience. And then there are all of these other rituals that she does throughout each episode. She encourages people to thank their objects before they decide to discard them. She encourages people to tap the books so that their spirits can be awakened before the people decide to sort them. So all of these rituals throughout each episode that reinforce the presentation of Marie Kondo as a spiritual leader and not just a regular old home organization consultant, even though that's how she describes herself.
Let's bring in a call now. Let's go to Kelly joining us, Kelly joining us from Cascade. Kelly, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I love Marie Kondo. I've done her tidying up and read her book. It greatly appealed to me. I'm actually a Christian mystical priest, which is probably quite unknown. We would probably be considered renegades or heretics. I'm not practicing currently, but deep in the Christian tradition and in a lot of the practices of the monks was a practice to leave the things of your past behind. So monks would go into sometimes in caves or they'd have small rooms, they'd have a little bedside table or shrine and just a very few things. And that's very common in Christian tradition as well. We've just gotten far away from it. I actually was introduced to her in the process of leaving my former practice and role as a priest to kind of be with my husband and children more full on, and just found myself not really knowing what to do with all the stuff and that was accumulating. And she kind of brought me back to what was already a part of my own spiritual path.
So Kelly, you're seeing parallels there in part to Christian traditions. Melissa?
Yeah, I don't think that's uncommon. I think that there is something about religious encounter in general that causes people on either religious side to reflect and recognize elements of themselves in a new way. So I don't think it's uncommon for people to read her book or watch her TV show or do her method and reflect upon their own tradition and find resonances there. There was a really fascinating op-ed written in the Washington Post by a professor from Liberty University a few years ago in which she also talked about Marie Kondo's method through a distinctly Christian lens, talking about cleanliness and godliness. And seeing that while there are clearly differences between Shintoism and Christianity, a lot of similarity. So I think it's important to remember that encounter, which is what I think her show involves seeing difference, but also acknowledging similarity.
We're exploring our perception of Marie Kondo, looking at the spiritual underpinnings and how they translate here in the West. Marie Kondo greets every house that she tidies serenely, getting onto her knees, bowing. Everything within the house is holy to be treated with reverence and respect. Melissa Borja is our guide. She's an assistant professor of American culture specializing in Asian American religion at the University of Michigan. You can join in 800-642-1234. What do you think of Marie Kondo's approach to life and home? What do you make of her more spiritual approach to an orderly life? Can you draw parallels to your own religion? Join in, email ideas at WPR.org. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. We're talking about how spirituality can be impacted by racist assumptions. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and we're learning why it's important to respect the spirituality behind Marie Kondo's Tidying Up. Here's a moment from the trailer for her Netflix show, Tidying Up with Marie Kondo.
I'm so excited because I love mess.
Hello, I'm Marie Kondo. My mission is to make the world happy.
She says, my mission is to spark joy in the world through cleaning. Have you followed Marie Kondo's work? Do you connect with the more spiritual parts of her tidying up method? Why or why not? We're at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Melissa Borja is our guide. She's an assistant professor of American culture at the University of Michigan. Let's go back to the phones now with Wyatt joining us from Saul River. Wyatt, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My comment is, I haven't read Kondo's book, but I have seen her show. I just see a lot of parallels to Bushido, which is samurai living, and Japanese philosophies in that way, and really the message of self-control. And I don't think we see that as much in Western philosophy. So I wonder if that's why people are really drawn to it. We're kind of missing that piece in our life. And I'll take any comments off air.
Wyatt, thanks. So he's picking up on this self-control that perhaps we have an appetite for because it's missing.
Wyatt, thanks so much for your comment. I think you point to something that is an important part of this Oriental monk trope, which is the identification of deficiencies in Western and American culture in particular, and the possibilities that Eastern traditions might offer for greater wisdom and transformation and betterment. So yes, I think it's very possible that Marie Kondo's beliefs and approaches to tidying up have resonances with other aspects of Japanese culture. And I guess one thing we should ask ourselves as part of a Western audience that is really fascinated with all these aspects of Japanese culture and religion is, why are we so fascinated with it? And what needs does it meet and desires does it meet that we have? And so, yeah, self-control might be part of it. A desire for less stuff, a desire for greater serenity and peace and tranquility and wisdom. I think that it's important for us to reflect on what exactly you're pointing to, which is a sense of what we might be missing in our lives now here.
Let's bring in Steve now, joining us from Adam's Friendship. Hi, Steve.
Hello.
What's on your mind about Marie Kondo?
Well, I was thinking that maybe it's not just the religious thing. I mean, there's another show called Hoarders where people, they finally took it off the air, but they had people call it back because it's such a good show because people like seeing other people's messes and how they get cleaned up. They don't like see, they're kind of comparing themselves to how dirty their houses are.
Steve, have you seen Marie Kondo's show?
I haven't seen a part of it. I only seen like a segment of it, but that's about it. I have both of her books. I just haven't got to read it yet.
What attracts you to wanting to get her books, or what are you curious about?
Well, I like to, you know, declutter my life because, well, I have a lot of books and stuff like that, but maybe there's a psychological thought process to how she does it versus, you know, how a psychologist for hoarding does. You know, she makes it seem nicer versus, you know, the scientific thought process to it.
Yeah, so maybe there's something deeper there, Melissa.
Yeah, I think one thing that is really striking about Marie Kondo is how gentle and warm she is. She never criticizes the people that she helps. She never insults them. And to be honest, if you look at the homes she addresses and the homes in Hoarders, it's like a completely different scale. The homes that she visits are really not that messy. I mean, maybe that's a commentary on the messiness of my own home, but I didn't think that they were particularly messy. But what she really is doing is excavating their issues that underlie their things. So she's tidying up their homes, which aren't that messy, really, but really helping them tidy up their relationships with other people in their lives, especially at moments of big transition. And she does so in a way that's very gentle and warm. And so I think that that is certainly an appeal. She's not a psychiatrist or a psychologist. She's not pathologizing the people. But then again, they don't have kind of the big problems that the Hoarders do. But they are looking for transformation and a gentle leader to help them achieve that.
Marie Kondo was on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert in February, and she helped Stephen clean up his desk. And let's hear now some of that show, and you'll hear Kondo, her translator, and then Colbert.
So I usually do this in my heart, but you can verbalize it just for today. Just express the gratitude you have for the studio, what this desk and the studio allows you to do this amazing show every night.
もちろん声に出してもいいですよ、今回。
You can verbalize what you're feeling inside too.
I don't understand anything you're saying when you say it, but even if you had no translator, I would follow you to a cult compound and never leave.
What do you see? What do you hear there in that exchange?
Well, I hear Stephen Colbert acknowledging the spirituality and the appeal of her. In other words, the spiritualness of why she is so powerful to people. And he was making a joke of it. And I think if you asked him, I'm not sure he would actually describe her as leading a cult. But I think that there is a recognition of her charisma and her magnetism and the centrality of her spirituality in that. And I think that is true for a lot of people. This is why she is so powerful to Americans and why this show, I think, is going to be quite impactful, not only in the short term, but in the long term, because it will reinforce really powerful ideas about Asian spirituality and the potential of Asia to offer the West renewal, wisdom, and transformation.
Let's go to Sharon now in Minocqua. Sharon, hi.
Hi. Great show. I love Marie Kondo. I'm part Japanese. My mother's Japanese. I teach Asian watercolor painting classes. And the Japanese philosophy of simplicity is something Marie Kondo just really brings. That's what her entire business is based on, is just simplifying your life. And that's true also in Asian art. They try to just make sure that you are just leaving space in the painting in order to let the energy and let the viewer pass through the art. And that philosophy in Japan is, it's about simplification. And it's very challenging, I think, in a lot of Western cultures, or here in the United States especially, because we base so much on the accumulation of things. Even in art, people paint to the four corners of the page or to the canvas, as opposed to leaving the spaces open. And, I just wanted to compare that to Asian art, the philosophy in Asian art as well.
Sharon, thank you for bringing that in. Melissa, bringing the artistic side in there and comparison.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right, that there's also an aesthetic dimension in addition to the philosophical and spiritual dimensions of Marie Kondo's appeal. And I think it's worth pointing out also that there are traditions within Western religion and Western art that emphasize space and emptiness as well, but perhaps not to the same degree that we're seeing with Japanese traditions. I think that's an important aspect. I'm not making the argument that all of Marie Kondo's appeal can be summed up in her spiritual aspects. I think there are aesthetic dimensions as well.
Well, Melissa, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I have enjoyed this conversation so much. Thank you.
Melissa Borja is an assistant professor of American culture at the University of Michigan, where she specializes in refugee migration and Asian American religion. Just ahead, Recovery Alignment Day takes place at the Wisconsin Capitol tomorrow. We'll talk about the event and what event organizers want to talk about in terms of recovery. I'm Kate Archer Kent. It's The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.